I'm just going to start here by reading, well, I'll first explain a little bit, and then I'll read from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary. There are four verses in the Srimad Bhagavatam that are called the Chatur Shloki verses, and those four verses are the essence of the entire 18,000 verses. And that means that there's a lot packed in them. And the approach of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is to take each word and clusters of those words in the verses and then explain their meaning, like unpack them. So the first of the Chatur Shloki verses, they're in Canto 2, Chapter 9, starts with text 33. So that verse is, well, it states, before creation, I alone exist. During the period of cosmic manifestation, I alone exist. And after annihilation, I alone exist. So this is the emphasis here is the non-difference between Krishna and the expansions of Krishna. There's a difference and a non-difference. So this verse is emphasizing the non-difference feature. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave us this achintya bed abeda tattva, the truth that the teaching that all things that exist have their source of emanation, but those things in relation to their source are not the energetic, they're not the equal in all respects to their source of emanation. So there's a relationship, an inseparable relationship. So, the second verse kind of says the same thing the other way around. It says that if one sees something as existing separately from its source of emanation, and there's artha or value in that something just in its own existence, know that to be my illusory energy. Seeing like that is the effect of Krishna's illusory energy. And he uses a metaphor that this is like reflected light in darkness. By definition, darkness means without light. So where is there light in darkness? Answer, there isn't any. But there may appear to be light and darkness, like a reflecting surface, like a mirror. And in darkness, one might see in the reflection of a mirror some light. But that's not the original light, it's a reflection of light, but it gives some illumination. Similarly, seeing something of value in this world, seeing happiness in matter, potential happiness, or even happiness in matter, it's the illusory energy. It's something, just like a reflection is something, but it's not like, you know, here's an apple and here is a mirror and there's the reflection of the apple. So what's in the mirror? It's a reflection of an apple. But there's no substance apple there. You can't get any nourishment. No matter how hungry you are, it's not going to help you chewing on the reflection in the mirror. It's insubstantial. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur uses this example several times, and he discloses where it comes from. It's directly from a verse and from the scripture. The example is the example of a lamp in a room, and within the room there's also a pot and a cloth. And when the light from the lamp shines upon the pot and the cloth, then you can see the pot and you can see the cloth. But when you remove the lamp, although the pot and the cloth are there, you cannot see them. And in that state of darkness, there may be fear of a thief or a snake, although there may not be a snake or a thief. In darkness, we have fears of something that doesn't even exist. But there's a fear. It's insubstantial. So then he takes that description of what the material creation is, and then he starts moving it in the direction of the yogamaya potency, because Mahamaya, or the illusory potency, is a expansion of the internal potency, or reflection of the internal potency. Just like we find in Sri Brahma Samhita that Mahavishnu is described, and he's associating with his internal potency, Rama Devi. And while he is enjoying his pastimes with Rama Devi, he sees at a distance the reflection of Rama Devi in the form of Pradhan. And he sees that Pradhan has nothing to do, and she's very unhappy. So he doesn't like to see her unhappy. He gives her something to do. He gives her the something to do just by glancing. And by glancing over Pradhan, immediately she has so much to do. She is impregnated with all the living entities that were within the body of Mahavishnu during the resting period, during the night of Brahma. And as he exhales and glances over Pradhan, along with the time energy, the living entities enter, and Pradhan then begins differentiating into the Mahatattva and supplies all the ingredients for all the different living entities. So she has a lot to do. Engage living entities in Maya. Well, Maya is a reflection. He uses the word vibhuti. Like Kirti Dai yesterday was speaking about the 10th chapter Bhagavad Gita of aquatics, I am the shark, she kept referring to, but you know, of light, I am the sun and the moon, and of the strength, I'm the prowess of all powerful men, I'm the intelligence of the intelligence, and so on. I'm immovable things, I am mountains. So the opulences of Krishna's are, and in the material world, are vibhutis. And those vibhutis indicate the bhagas, or the spiritual opulences of Krishna in the spiritual world. And both the vibhutis and the bhagas of Krishna indicate the powerful. He's the possessor of power. Bhagavan. He's the possessor of power, of opulences. So, now going back to the living entity, because there's matter and spirit in the controller of both. And one will not recognize the controller of both if one is under the deluding influence of matter. But the message of the Bhagavatam is how to get, and the message of our life, the mission of our life, is to get to the position of recognition of Krishna, the controller of both, matter and spirit. So he then goes very deeply. It's like, you know, you have to be really expert to carefully follow the points that he's making, to go step by step and describe how this Mahamaya has its spiritual counterpart as Yogamaya. And Yogamaya also serves to reveal, like a lamp can reveal the pot and the cloth in the room, Yogamaya acts to reveal different aspects and features of Krishna. The Paramatma feature, first Atma, then Paramatma, then Bhagavan. He goes through those three stages. I'll do a gloss and then I'll read. He says, knowledge tinged by or influenced by sattva guna can allow one to realize the presence of Atma, but not of Paramatma. Bhakti, in the quality of goodness, can take one to Paramatma realization, but Shuddha Bhakti alone, in its fullness, where there's no taint of the modes of nature, can bring one to the position of realization of Bhagavan. I'll read. When pure bhakti, which is the mercy of the Lord incarnate, and the essence of all the chit shakti, becomes very strong and prominent by amount and type, it is completely independent and does not consider good or bad, and may appear suddenly within conditioned jivas, even of bad conduct, who are born of rakshasas, pulindas, and pulkishas, where it may not appear within brahmanas or sannyasis, even if they are liberated. But that bhakti alone, and by that bhakti alone, all suffering, including avidya, is destroyed. It is said, this is from Lord Kapila's teachings to Devahuti, that bhakti dissolves the subtle body of the living entity. Like, you know, that, like dropping an Alka-Seltzer in a glass of water, and just, it's dissolved, it's gone. The mind, think about it. Your mind, material mind, becomes dissolved by bhakti. What a relief, huh? There's a commercial for you. Just as fire in the stomach digests all that we eat, gone. The material mind is gone through devotional service. By that bhakti alone, a person will realize directly Bhagavan, filled with bliss and knowledge, just as a person with strong eyesight, by good fortune, can see the general form of the beautiful deity and also the details of the face, hands, nose, eyes, and ears. Then a long discussion of bhakti is mixed and unmixed by the modes of nature. He goes through this state, realizing Atma, realizing Paramatma. Then he goes to the full unmixed Yogamaya. That Yogamaya, by my will, has qualities of revealing and obscuring, like light and darkness. An example, he gives four examples. So this is Krishna's pastimes. How Krishna's pastimes are moved or advanced, they play out by the Yogamaya potency. An example may be given. In order to show that Mother Yashoda's love could not be restricted by a show of Krishna's power, Yogamaya revealed the material universe within his stomach, while simultaneously revealing the spiritual forms of Gokul, Yashoda, and Krishna. Because the verse is speaking, so this is Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur. The verse is speaking about how Maya covers reality, like the absence of light. You can't see the cloth in the pot. You can't see reality. So Krishna is reality, and Krishna's abode is reality. But Yogamaya works in such a way that Mother Yashoda is right before Krishna, and because of Yogamaya, she doesn't see him as the personality Godhead. She looks inside his mouth and sees the cosmic manifestation. But she also sees Mother Yashoda looking inside Krishna's mouth, within Krishna's mouth, as she's looking at Krishna. His comment is, bewildered by Yogamaya, Yashoda perceived that directly, and after a moment did not perceive it, since Yogamaya covered that realization. Then he gives another example, Arjuna's vision of the universal form. In order to show how prema is restricted by realization of power, Arjuna realizes the universal form and the form of Paramatma when it was revealed by Yogamaya. Because of the covering of Yogamaya, he did not experience the Sarup of Krishna, which was still present. Meaning, Krishna was right next to him in the chariot. And because of Yogamaya, he was not consciously aware of Krishna right next to him. He was aware of the universal form and saying, please remove this universal form and show that form of yours, which is right next to him. At other times, he did not experience either the universal form or Paramatma, which was covered by Yogamaya, but experienced Krishna's two-armed form. At one time, one form of the Lord was revealed, while another was covered. This is how it is different from Yogamaya acting on Yashoda's, in Yashoda's case, in the first example. She was simultaneously seeing both Krishna and the cosmic manifestation, not one alternatively and then the other. Here's another example. In order to destroy Brahma's thinking that he was the controller, Yogamaya, by showing sweetness and power, made the real calves and cowherd boys invisible and showed calves and boys who were Krishna himself, and then made those forms invisible and showed the forms of Vishnu with four arms. Then Yogamaya made those Vishnu forms disappear and showed the form of Krishna. Brahma was bewildered by these acts of Yogamaya. The unique quality of Yogamaya's action here is that the one form of Brahma observed repeated coverings and revelations of various forms of the Lord. Then he analyzes and gives one more pastime example. In order to show the inconceivable nature of his form, being both limited and unlimited by its very nature, and in order to show that he is brought under control by the efforts of pure devotees and by his mercy arising from seeing those efforts, Yogamaya assisted in the Damodar pastime. Yashoda wanted to bind Krishna. At the same time, Krishna did not want to be bound. Simultaneously, covering his power, Yogamaya allowed Yashoda to tie a string of bells around his waist, but displaying his power did not allow her to tie a rope around his waist. In Jiva Goswami's commentary, he says the elder gopis came when she was getting more ropes and tying them together, and they laughed at her. He said, "Don't you understand, Mother Yashoda? It's not intended for you to tie Krishna. In the morning, you had a little string with bells, and you tied a little string with bells around Krishna's waist, and it was very easy. And now you have so much rope. And so much more rope, and so much more rope, and it's not going around Krishna's waist. It's not meant to happen. Just accept it." The rope was always 2 fingers too short. Yashoda, bewildered by Yogamaya, which made it impossible for her to bind Krishna according to his wish, so his wish was predominating her wish, Krishna wanted to go and eat more butter and play in the storeroom. Mother Yashoda wanted to bind him. Mother Yashoda experienced great astonishment for a moment. This power was then covered by Yogamaya by Krishna's consent in order to fulfill Yashoda's desire. Then she bound Krishna. The outstanding feature of Yogamaya in this case is the simultaneous covering up and displaying the power of Krishna. So, one more comes, but the reference is going back to how the deluding potency covers Krishna and covers reality with a capital R. One can't see reality. But instead one sees value in something which has no value, or one sees substance in something that has no substance. One sees happiness and it's something that there's no happiness. That's Mahamaya. So Mahamaya covers reality and produces another kind of reality that's illusion. Yogamaya does the same with pure devotees. But in the case of pure devotees, the covering, uncovering, in different ways of Krishna's pastimes, it's all for enhancing and amplifying the love of the devotee for Krishna. That's the difference between Yogamaya and Mahamaya. Varieties of loving dealing with Krishna is Yogamaya. The final paragraph I'll read. In order to fulfill invitations to each party, Krishna simultaneously manifested his form to Shrutadeva and Bahalashva. You know that story from the 10th canto Bhagavatam, towards the end of the 10th canto. Krishna is in Dwarka. And he has this very dear devotee, King Bahulashva, who lives very far away and is always engaged in service to Krishna, but never, because he's so busy in his service to Krishna, he never gets to come to Dwarka and see Krishna. So Krishna decides he'll go and see Bahulashva. But there's many things that Krishna is accomplishing with that. He takes this whole entourage and royal army and they go kind of like a, you know, from city to city or nation to nation, kingdom to kingdom, and gives his association to so many other kings. And there's grand festival and jubilation and meeting with Krishna. By the time he gets to Bahalashva's kingdom, Bahalashva has heard Krishna is coming to see me. He's so happy. that when Krishna comes, he's running to the edge of the kingdom to greet Krishna. But also in his kingdom is a great Brahmin, pure devotee, Shrutadev. And both of them come before Krishna at the same time. Both of them having the same desire in their heart, Krishna, please come and visit my home. So what does Krishna do? He expands into two Krishnas. Simultaneously, he goes with King Bahulashva and he goes with Shrutadev. And they're both thinking, oh, Krishna is so attached to me. He's come all the way from Dwarka and he's coming to my home. Or to Rukmini and Satyabhama in their houses. What to speak of the other 16,106 wives. So, but these two principal wives, queens, Rukmini and Satyabhama, Krishna is expanding himself into two Krishnas, one in each of their palaces. By yoga maya, he could perform his pastimes in each place by hiding the other form and revealing one form to the other party, simultaneously manifesting two different forms for Shrutadev and Bahalashva, and hiding one form from each is different from Yogamaya acting only upon one person, such as Yashoda. Krishna was within the mouth of Krishna. But she wasn't seeing the Krishna that was... She saw the Krishna that was within the mouth, but she wasn't seeing the Krishna, the mouth of Krishna. She wasn't seeing them both. All of this is performed by yoga maya, not by material maya. Since the persons who become bewildered by yoga maya get to see at least Paramatma. He goes, it's just such a beautiful purport. He describes that Kamsa, he also saw Krishna. He saw Krishna because by Krishna's will, Krishna manifested himself before Kamsa. But when Kamsa saw Krishna, he didn't see Paramatma. He didn't see Bhagavan. He saw death personified. He saw a human being like me, and he's more powerful. I'll be destroyed, because it was foretold I'll be destroyed. But because there was no devotion, he didn't see Bhagavan, although he was manifest before him. So this is this revealing and concealing. The act of Mahamaya acts like Naham Prakasha Sarvasha Yogamaya Samavrata Mudhoyam Navijanati. Krishna is describing in Bhagavad Gita that the mudhas, foolish persons, he's never manifest before them. But he's not manifest before them by the agency of his expansion, Mahamaya. Like when Kamsa tried to kill the sixth child of Devaki, he didn't see Yogamaya. He saw Durga. And what Durga is but an expansion of Yogamaya, known by those persons who don't have attraction for Krishna or devotion for Krishna. They have either a desire to enjoy material happiness, or they're afraid of being punished for their sinful activity. And so they don't see Yogamaya. Yogamaya is there. The internal potency is there. The vidya potency is there for those that are not inimical or Brahmabhuta prasanatma nasochati nakangsati, verses quoted here by him. samak sarveshu bhuteshu mad bhaktim labhate param. That's just a sharing thing. It's not meant for anything more than that. Our acharyas are so wonderful. Our disciplic line is just amazing. And what Prabhupada has done in the form of his Bhaktivedanta purports is take these wonderful commentaries and writings of our acharyas and simplify them so that an audience that may not be so learned in Vedic terminology and so on and so on and so on can appreciate the essence of devotion and go forward in their spiritual lives. By reading the commentaries of, this is my experience, by reading the commentaries of our acharyas, it makes me appreciate even more two main things. One of them I just said, how Prabhupada simplified everything. The essence of what our acharyas have written are contained within Prabhupada's purports. There is a one-to-one fidelity. Prabhupada didn't add something, leave something out, is a one-to-one fidelity. But the language and the manner, the mode of presentation is so simple. So simple, so sublime. So easy to digest, to take in and assimilate. But at the same time, the essence is there. And how simply Srila Prabhupada has put it in his purports is one, and that everything that he speaks is derived from our acharyas. It's not the other kind, speculative presentation. It's just faithfully representing the message of our disciplic succession in an easily understandable form. So, when I was reading this morning, and it was like a bonus. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur was giving so much more to what that verse in unpacking, because he goes back to each of the Sanskrit words, yatha bhasa, and unpacking it and saying it can mean this, that it can mean that, and then he just expands. So that light, the illumination power of Krishna, in its absence is darkness. In its presence can also reveal and conceal things as Krishna desires. It Yogamaya enriches Krishna's, Krishna enjoys. And his enjoyment is different exchanges of loving dealings with his devotees. Some of those loving dealings are disclosing himself. Some of his loving dealings are concealing himself. Like when we were one of the places we went to in Vrindavan was Prem Sarovar. There's a very wonderful pastime, just like he is describing here, where it's near Varsana, and it's a very nice place. One of the things that's very nice about it is it's not commercialized. It's just real quiet, very peaceful. And one day, Krishna and Radha were seated by the side of a sarovar. And they were conversing and enjoying pastimes together. And Radharani was wearing a very fragrant garland. And the garland was so fragrant there were many bumblebees buzzing around the garland. And Radharani was disturbed by the bumblebees. So Krishna, seeing her disturbed countenance, he asked Madhu Mangal, "Madhu, can you please remove these bees? You have mantras. Can you make arrangement for the bees to go?" Madhu said, "I will take care." And after some time, Madhu Mangal came back and said, "Madhu has gone," which could mean many things, because he himself is Madhu Mangal, in short, Madhu. But he meant, Madhu, the bee, is gone. But Radharani, hearing Madhu has gone, her attachment is so much unto Krishna that when she heard Madhu, she thought Madhusudan is gone. And her thoughts became absorbed in Madhusudan has gone, Krishna has gone. And she began to cry, uncontrollable tears of separation, crying and crying and weeping, trembling. And Krishna speaking to her, saying, "Radha, what's wrong? You're feeling separation, but I'm right here. Radha, I'm right here." But she was so deep in that mood of separation, she was oblivious of Krishna's presence by the arrangement of Yogamaya. She wasn't seeing Krishna's presence. It was absorption in Krishna's absence. Madhu was gone. So moved by that feeling, deep feeling of separation and love for Krishna, that Krishna began crying. Tears of love for Radha. How much love, how intense is her love for me? He began crying tears of love, and the sarovar then became filled with both of their tears of love. Thus the name Prem Sarovar. The one who takes water from the tears of love of Radha and Krishna, depositing their transcendental love like that, there's another nice example from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastime. When he was making his attempt to visit Vrindavan, of course he's the supreme controller, he doesn't need to attempt anything. But he was attempting to go to Vrindavan, and he never made it, because his actual intent was to visit Sanatan and Rupa Goswami. So to go from Puri to Vrindavan is like, you know, on the map is, I guess for you, it's like this. But he went like this, because he went to Ramakeli to visit Rupa and Sanatan. Because the circumstance was that Rupa and Sanatan, Saraswat Brahmins by birth and by quality, were pure devotees of the Lord. And through their association with Vidya Vachaspati was the brother of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Some of you have been to Mayapur. We went to Vidyanagar. And in Vidyanagar, there's the home of Vidya Vachaspati, and behind is the home of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. They were brothers. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, before Mahaprabhu's appearance, went to Puri to become the chief priest of the king, Prataparudra. But his brother, Vidyavachaspati, stayed in Navadvip. So, because Sanatan and Rupa Goswami were such elevated Vaishnavas, when they came to hear about Vidyavachaspati's learning, they invited him to come and spend time in their court. And when he was in their court, they heard about Lord Chaitanya. And when they heard about Lord Chaitanya, they wanted to meet Lord Chaitanya. But he was in Puri, and they were in the service of the king. So they were writing letters sent by Brahmin messengers to Mahaprabhu, according to Bhakti Ratnakar. They never received a reply, but they continued sending messages to Lord Chaitanya, and he could understand their deep, deep devotion and qualification. So he decided he was going to pay them a visit in Ramakeli. So he went there, and he delivered them from the service of the king. After his visit, at the end of the visit, Sanatan Goswami gave two recommendations. He was such a qualified person. He's giving advice to Mahaprabhu. It's like Uddhava giving advice to Krishna. Krishna doesn't need advice from anybody, but he would turn to Uddhava for advice. So Sanatan Goswami offered some advice. He said, right now, Nawab Hussein is in a good mood, but he's a terribly vicious person. Tomorrow, he could try to kill you. He's very mean and cruel. As much as I would like you to stay here in Ramakeli, I advise that you leave at once for your own well-being. So Mahaprabhu accepted his advice. He left the next day. Then he gave some additional advice. He said, your plan is to go to Vrindavan, but with you are tens of thousands of people. And for a sadhu to enter Vrindavan, it should be solitary, or at most with one servant. Otherwise, it'll be a farce. It will not be respected by others. It will be seen as a farce. So best if you go to send those devotees back to Puri. He offered that advice. And Mahaprabhu considered his advice, and the next morning thought, this is correct. What he has said is correct. So, he began his pilgrimage heading back to Puri, but went a little bit further to Keturi. And Keturi is on the bank of the river Padma, because he wanted to take his bath in the river Padma. Described in Bhakti Ratnakar, he took his bath in the river Padma and turned to Lord Nityananda, saying, very soon one devotee will take his birth. His name will be Narottam, and he will become a great devotee. I have deposited my personal love for Krishna in the Padma River, and when he takes his bath in the Padma River, that Krishna Prema, the full Krishna Prema that I have, will become his. And everyone who heard this understood, whoever this Narottam is, how fortunate. He was famous even before he was conceived. Maharaj Parikshit was famous before he was born. Narottam was famous before he was even conceived. And Srinivasacharya in a similar way. So, by the Lord's will, his own internal potency can act however he directs it to act. And Krishna's lila is to reciprocate loving dealings with his devotees. And so Yogamaya acts in that way, sometimes concealing Krishna, apparently, like it's described in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, when the cowherd boys were herding the cows during the daytime, their attachment for Krishna was so intense that if for just a moment Krishna passed on the other side of a tree, they were in great anxiety not being able to see Krishna for that moment. Like we have in Shikshastakam, one moment of separation from Krishna seems like 12 years or more. Yugayatam nimeshena chakshusha pravishayatam. 12 years for a moment separation from Krishna. Time and space have totally different dimensions when it comes to attachment for Krishna. And that's how this happens, by the influence of Yogamaya. And that's Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on Mahamaya. Because to understand Mahamaya properly, we have to understand that Mahamaya is an expansion of Yogamaya. So how does Yogamaya act? I remember reading this in Bhagavad Gita years ago and wondering, we are accustomed to hearing Yogamaya in terms of the potency of Krishna's pastimes. So how is it that, where does this Yogamaya come in Bhagavad Gita, that by Krishna's Yogamaya, persons can't see him? Ever had that question? The answer is, it's the expansion of Yogamaya as Mahamaya. And by the expansion of Yogamaya as Mahamaya, persons can't see him. But Vyas, in the first canto Bhagavatam, is able to see Krishna because Maya is standing behind Krishna, under Krishna's order. Okay, Maya, leave them alone. Leave Vyasadeva alone. Come over here. Like calling a dog or something. Come on. Come on over here. So then, when the cloud is removed, one can see the sun. If the cloud is in the way, you can see the cloud. You know the sun is there, but you can't directly see the sun. And our one purport in the 10th canto of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says our goal or the objective of devotional service is to see Krishna. Or in the purified state of devotion, when there's Shuddha Bhakti, one can see Krishna as he is. And the disclosure of Krishna becomes ever increasing because Krishna is unlimited. The newness and freshness and the whole experience of Krishna is like waves in the ocean that just keep coming and coming and coming. Waves of transcendental happiness in relationship with Krishna by the agency of Yogamaya. So the next verse in the Chaturshloki describes the process of devotional service, how to overcome that maya. Very same thing as those verses where Vyasa is describing his realization. Having understood how maya works, then one can overcome it. At least the possibility is there. But if one doesn't understand at all how Maya works, one is still going to seek happiness where there's no happiness. And it's, you know, it's like the determination of a materialist is powerful. You know, bang your head against the wall, and how many times and how many lifetimes of banging your head against the wall, and it hurts, and you keep doing it, trying to find happiness where there's no happiness. Make it happen. Just do it smarter, or do it better, or get more of it, or something. Try it a different way. Lifetime after lifetime. It's like Jarasandha. How determined was Jarasandha? How many times was he totally humiliated? Krishna alone defeated his entire army. He had, you know, so many Akshohini divisions of soldiers and came again and got smashed by Krishna. Krishna didn't even use his own army. He just stood on the battlefield alone. Destroyed his whole army. He came back again and came back again. Came back again. So determined. I'll just share this one thing from our Vrindavan visit. I've been getting some little reports from devotees who took part in the Vrindavan Yatra. And probably number one point of appreciation, there were several, like way up there, but one of the places that the devotees especially appreciated was Puncharika Lota Baba. The Govardhan Hill is said to be shaped like a peacock. It's like a very narrow mountain that runs in a northern-southerly direction. And the top, where Radha Kunshamakund are, said to be the eyes of the peacock. And they're like a peacock that's standing on a branch. The belly is in the middle. So Manasi Ganga in the middle. And the mouth, like the peacock, sometimes has her head tucked down. So the mouth is in at Manasi Ganga. Mukharavind. And the ears of the peacock are Gwalpukar, place where the cowherd boys would meet and have their lunch, going down the eastern side of Govardhan. You go all the way down at the bottom, the very southernmost part of Govardhan, and there's Lauta Baba. So the story behind the Lauta Baba deity is Lauta was, he's not mentioned very many times in the Bhagavatam or Krishna book, but he was a very dear friend of Krishna. And he liked to serve Krishna. So he would regularly prepare lunch for Krishna and ask Krishna, or have lunch prepared, and then ask Krishna to have lunch. So on the very day that Krishna was to leave Vrindavan and go to Mathura with Akrura, Lauta Baba came to Krishna the very day and said, "Krishna, I prepared lunch for you. Can you please come to my home and have lunch?" And Krishna said, "I have to go now. Akrura has come to take me to Mathura, but I'll come back. I'll come back tomorrow or maybe the next day." So Lauta Baba said, "But your meal, I prepared your meal. And you've never refused. Please come to my home before you go to Vrindavan and have your meal, please." And Krishna said, "No, I have to leave now. But I'll come back. I'll come back tomorrow. Or the day after tomorrow. At most, the day after that. I'll come back." Lauta Baba said, "If you don't take your meal, I'll just sit here and fast." And Krishna said, "No, don't worry. I'll come back. tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, I'll come back. So Lonta Baba said, then I'll sit right here. You're leaving that way for Mathura, then I'll just wait. I'll watch the path for you to come back. Krishna said, I'll come back. I promise you, I'll come back. So Lonta Baba sat and waited for the day, and the next day, and the day after that, just waiting for Krishna to fulfill his promise that he would come back. And he waited for a week, just watching the path, waiting for a month. Krishna didn't come back. But Krishna said he would come back. So Lota Baba just waited and waited, and eventually they made a deity of where Lota Baba was sitting, waiting for Krishna to come back, very faithfully, knowing that Krishna will keep his word, Krishna will come back. But it's another very peaceful place, and the mood of having such strong faith in the word of Krishna, that when it looks like, oh wow, Krishna broke his word, Krishna didn't come back. But in a higher sense, our acharyas describe that Krishna never leaves Vrindavan, because in this lila of Krishna leaving Vrindavan, he enters into the hearts of his devotees. He never leaves Vrindavan. And it's Vasudev Krishna, who was born in the prison house of Kamsa, the son of Vasudev and Devaki, he went to Mathura. But the original personality of Godhead, Krishna, never leaves Vrindavan. He entered into the heart of Lota Bhava and the gopis and all of his dear devotees. Krishna never leaves Vrindavan. And Krishna may appear in Vrindavan, but he's just making himself manifest, like this Yogamaya influence of Krishna being appearing and Krishna disappearing. Or Mother Yashoda seeing Krishna inside of Krishna's mouth, and seeing herself inside of Krishna's mouth. How can you do that? See yourself somewhere. By his Yogamaya potency. And then it all disappears. By Krishna's Yogamaya potency. So those who are, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, those who are faithless, they'll never understand. To them it's double talk and imagination and, you know, foolishness. It's a complete waste of time. You should just, you know, get a job, make some money, enjoy life. Chase after that reflection of light and darkness. Find value in things that are separate from their source of emanation, and try to own and enjoy and exploit them. That's life. So that the Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita take us into, especially with the assistance of such capable acharyas, take us into such wonderful understandings of Krishna, disclosing, revealing Krishna's identity and his loving exchanges. So I got a stack of questions here, but I'm going to start with where the idea came from of having some questions and answers. Someone sent me a question just before I came to Chicago. I said, I'll answer it here at the program. So, two questions. How can we strike a balance between having confidence in our Krishna consciousness and exhibiting arrogance, with feelings of hopelessness and humility, as opposed to getting into the lamentative mentality? You got the question? Should I read it again? Here it is again. How can we strike a balance between having confidence in our Krishna consciousness and exhibiting arrogance with feelings of hopelessness and humility as opposed to getting into the lamentative mentality? Well, two things. One is humility with spiritual conception means feeling great confidence in Krishna, or feeling great confidence in our devotional service is with a genuine feeling of humility. It's not depending upon ourselves, our prowess, our intelligence, our cleverness, our ability. It's confidence in Krishna. And that confidence in Krishna becomes possible when there's genuine humility. So when there's a spiritual conception of humility, there's no place for hopelessness, lamentation. Lamentation is a symptom of ignorance. It's not a fine line at all. It's a big distinction between regret. So we're devotees, and all of us, not only can, we regularly do make mistakes. I make mistakes. I imagine most of us in the room make mistakes. When we make mistakes, Bhaktivinoda Thakur teaches, it's purifying to regret that we made the mistake. And we should be not unwilling or, you know, be too proud to apologize for the mistake. If you make a mistake, you amend for the mistake. Sincerely, genuinely. But if you dwell, oh, I made a mistake, and you just get stuck. It's like we were going to Mansarovar. When we were in Vrindavan, it rained. It never rains in November. Dita Bandhu told us it never rains in November, but it rained in November. And so some of the places we were going to, we couldn't get to because it was all mud. So we had this one driver. He was like, you know, the lead driver. So we were in the lead car with Dina Bandhu, and he decided he would just like plow through the mud. Well, guess what? He got stuck in the mud. So as much as he spun the wheel, it just spun the wheel. And mud was flying in all directions going out behind the car, but the car wasn't going forward. It was just spinning the wheel and mud flying. That's all that was happening. Lamentation is like that. You don't go anywhere. Just like, you go down. It's the mode of ignorance. It's surrendering to the mode of ignorance. That's what lamentation is. So devotees don't surrender to the mode of ignorance. They rise above the modes of ignorance. Nishtraigunya Bhavarjana. And take shelter of Krishna. And when you take shelter of Krishna, knowing that I'm this really tiny little speck of a living entity, literally insignificant, but Krishna is significant, and he's not only significant, he's very kind upon even the insignificant. So there's humility, and so then one, with humility, one takes shelter in Krishna, and then one has confidence. It's not confidence in one's own little tiny speck-like existence. It's confidence in Krishna. That's real confidence. So real confidence like that, there's no room for arrogance because it's Krishna, not me. So Krishna gave us a little intelligence. We got some stones and got, we even found a little, you know, a stick, a few sticks, and put the sticks and the stones under the wheel. And, you know, a few more turns and he was out of the mud. But it wasn't like, yay, we did it. Because the sticks and the stones and the intelligence came from Krishna. And it wasn't a good idea to drive through the mud, we told him. You know, he should have gone around. There's a longer route, but it's safer. So Krishna is a supplier of intelligence. It's not us. So humility, when one is doing nicely in Krishna consciousness, it's because the mercy of Krishna is being accessed. And it's the merciful nature of Krishna. And our willingness to acknowledge our very tiny position before him. And then that's, you know, a very confident position. While we're very confident, we should also be very careful. Because if we become proud of the little success that we have to become a little humble, then it's over. We're covered again. So therefore, a devotee that's genuinely progressing in spiritual life will become consistently humble. Not like when you're stuck in the mud, you become humble. When you're having a problem, you become humble because you need to depend upon Krishna. And then you're out of the mud and the problem is over and you become casual. Or complacent. But where humility is consistent before Krishna, I'm fully dependent, then that's success in spiritual life. One can be very confident in that position. The other hope, the material kind of hopelessness, the material kind of humility, the material kind of lamentation, mode of ignorance. Mode of ignorance. And one should say no to the mode of ignorance and say yes to Krishna. Take proper shelter. Here's the other question. A lot of time I feel like there are so many instructions to apply in my Krishna consciousness, so rather than allowing those instructions to strengthen my Krishna consciousness, I become overwhelmed and end up not wholeheartedly applying anything. How can I get rid of this feeling, even though there are so many things to be improved upon in myself? Some advice is start with chanting. Start with, you know, real fundamental basics and work on those things. Work on attentive chanting. And then out of the so many instructions that are there, pick one or two with the assistance of those who are guiding you in your Krishna consciousness. Pick one or two and work on one or two. Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes in Amnaya Sutra, there's a little section that he describes overcoming, forget the word that he uses, bad habits or something, a word for bad habits. And he says, to overcome a bad habit, it takes about 5 years. Then he, you know, does a little math and says, you know, supposing an average person has about 30 bad habits. So it's a lifetime. But, you know, spend 5 years getting rid of a bad habit. So you'll find that if you focus on one thing that's, you know, important in your life, you consider and those guiding you help you consider, this is important. When you start getting, making real breakthroughs in that one thing, you'll find that other things are also following right behind. The converse of what this thing says, that there's so many I don't do anything. Do one thing and so many things start to follow. But of those so many things that we have to do, the one most important thing is the chanting of the holy name. That's our primary means of deliverance in this age. And right behind that one is serving the devotees in a humble mood. Do those two things. Let all the other things, you know, happen as best they can happen. Do those two things. That's a teaching of Mahaprabhu found right in Chaitanya Charitamrita. The residents of Kalinagram asked Mahaprabhu when leaving Puri, what's our duty? Specifically, it was the duty of a householder. Chant the holy name constantly, as far as possible. And whenever there's opportunity, serve the devotees of the Lord in a humble mood. So, do your hearing and chanting nicely. Serve the devotees of the Lord. And then the rest is important, but it's detail that will be enriched by doing those two things nicely. So, what to do here? Okay. I'm relatively new to the path of Krishna consciousness. My realization is that in the last 1 year, everything in my life, including my spiritual and materialistic activities, have made a consistent progress. I couldn't be happier, except, of course, controlling the mind is a big challenge. The question is, I am not sure I'm getting more and more attached to Krishna because I'm pleasing him or because it is making me happier. How to increase my devotional service just to please Krishna and not for my happiness or sense gratification? That's a nice question. I hope they're all like this. The mere fact that you're reflecting this way is a good measure of protection. Because when you're thinking this way, Krishna will give you prompts. He'll disclose to you where the tendency for thinking of my happiness, and that translates into my sense gratification, gross or subtle, is in the foreground. And a very clear symptom of that's the case is when the elements aren't right, devotional service slackens. Or the other way around, when everything is going very nicely, my devotional service slackens. Now I'm in this position of enjoyment, of happiness, so the submission unto Krishna factor reduces. You know, Maya means devotional service decreases. So over time, if devotional service is decreasing, that's a clear sign. The protection is be careful and maintain oneself in a humble position. The humble position meaning I'm very tiny. I'm very tiny. And in a moment, a strong wind can come and I'm knocked over. So I need Krishna's shelter. I don't want to leave Krishna's lotus feet. Krishna, please protect me. That humility is itself and calling for Krishna's protection all the while. Then Krishna's protection will be there. Especially the person writing this, being a new devotee, be assured there's a mix. The happiness of Krishna and the happiness of, you know, my own contentment. Largely that means, you know, a decreasing of the volume of disturbance. Not exactly a positive happiness, but a decreasing of the volume of disturbances. But that volume can easily increase very quickly. And then, you know, what happened to the happiness? So let the devotion to Krishna continue despite, you know, whether the barometer reads over on this side or on that side. Regardless of the feature of duality that's being presented to you, continue faithfully in your service to Krishna. Someone had submitted several questions, the same handwriting. The desire for attention / recognition is a subtle form of lust. How to get rid of this? In the writing of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he describes just as it's presented here. Lust, kamesha, krodesha, rajoguna samudbhava. From Bhagavad Gita, contact with the mode of passion results in the desire to enjoy. And the desire to enjoy can be in a gross form or can be in a subtle form. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes when one is progressing through the modes of nature and even progressing a little into the spiritual level, spiritual dimension, there's a sense of happiness. It's described in the Bhagavad Gita. One becomes conditioned by a sense of happiness in the quality of goodness, or with spiritual success, a desire or some recognition for some spiritual success starts to come. And if one tries to be or allows oneself to be the enjoyer of that little success, then immediately one goes back down again. One becomes contaminated by that mood of enjoyment. In spiritual life, it's meant to be carried out in a happy, joyful manner. Param vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtanam. It's a joyful process. But that joy is in the happiness of Krishna. So seeing that Krishna is at the center continuing to check oneself. Krishna's happiness is first. And by Krishna's happiness, then our happiness follows because Krishna is happy. That's what the life of devotion is. But it's true, the material conditioned side of life, or you can even say it in a simpler way, it's just natural that people want someone to recognize them. But that's a conditioned state. And when that recognition comes, does it really bring satisfaction? It doesn't bring real satisfaction. And if one can continue joyfully, whether there's recognition, non-recognition, that's the spiritual platform. We find these examples just because of recently being in Vrindavan. It's very fresh in my mind. Gopal Bhatta Goswami, Lokanath Goswami, Srupa Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, one after the Raghunath Das Goswami, they all had this quality that they did not want the recognition of others. As elevated as they were, like Lokanath Goswami, for example, he was approached by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami for the blessing to write Chaitanya Charitamrita. And he gave his blessing on one condition: you don't mention my name at all. Although he was such an intimate associate of Lord Chaitanya, don't mention my name at all. And because Krishnadas saw Lokanath as his spiritual superior, he didn't mention his name at all. He was such a humble devotee. So pure. And because he was so pure and so humble, people were honoring him, and he had no interest in honor. So it was difficult for him. So he would go live in seclusion. But Rupa and Sanatan Goswami wanted his association. And he saw them as his superior. So he came into their association. So he was receiving all this honor and respect. When one is really qualified, one doesn't want those things. And when one is really qualified and doesn't want those things, one gets those things. And the opposite is, when one wants those things, one is unqualified and one doesn't get those things. And if one gets those things, it's from someone that's also in Maya, or just trying to exploit you for something. And it leads to contamination. So the aspiration for purity, not just, you know, I want to be selfless. Even that idea, is what does that mean? I'm thinking of how selfless I am. I'm at the center again. So, role models, our pure devotee acharyas who have those qualities so powerfully, so completely. Here's a method of overcoming this tendency. Pick your favorite acharya. Absorb yourself in understanding about their life. Read about them. Read their writings. Describe them to others. Find out as much as you can about them. And when you see how elevated they are and how selfless they are and how non-egocentric they are, that will lift you to that position. It works. Associate with a pure devotee and you become pure. And one can associate in that way that I just mentioned. One can say, oh, Lokanath Goswami was so long ago. And Rupa and Sanatan Goswami, they're gone. But through entering into the descriptions of their lives and their writings, any hope, any aspiration, any expectation for some special recognition for us, just for ourselves, just is gone. There's no place for it. Okay. Unity in diversity is the heading here. Recently, we have heard from your Vyasa Puja address about this. Before, during, and after your GBC meetings, you have emailed us on this topic. Previously, I would feel inspired to hear and want to be able to be of some service in this regard. However, more recently, my heart has sunk and my faith seems to be scarred deeply. When I look at persons who I looked up to greatly as examples of this principle, and now they may not necessarily have unity in their diversity. How can I avoid my faith being damaged? How can I not allow this to happen? I don't know the detail of this example, but I'll make two different comments. One is, I'll use him by name, Rameswar. A disciple of Srila Prabhupada that did volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes, so much powerful service. And something happened. He got overwhelmed. He got hit by a tsunami of Maya. And he just like disappeared from the world of devotional service for some years. And now he's come back to devotional service. And when I see Rameswar, I think of the volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes of service that he did. And I also think of the pain that he caused when he left, because people were placing their faith upon him. And his intimate godbrothers, without mentioning names, they shared that with him. You know, when you left, we appreciate the volumes and volumes, but when you left, it really caused a lot of pain. A lot of pain. And, you know, he had his yeah, but, you know, there was still a lot of pain. So he's, every time he's spoken with me, with his, genuinely, very sincerely, with his head lowered, says, you know, I'm very sorry for the pain I caused so many people. He's not saying, you know, but look at all the volumes of service that I did. He's focused upon the remorse for that mistake. And that's glorious. Although there was pain caused to a number of people who were just relying upon him. Their faith was resting upon him. Prabhupada said, don't be surprised. So my point is, you honor that person, that great service that they've done, and if they get ambushed by Maya, don't be surprised. Prabhupada said it in this way. Don't be surprised when somebody leaves Krishna consciousness. Be surprised when somebody stays. Meaning, you know, the obstacles in this material world are so many. And a person who's making great sacrifices and taking great risks and so on, you know, that's glorious. But in the course of doing so, they may get wounded on the battlefield. And, you know, our concern should be to rescue them. Assuming that it's not something that's done viciously and so on. So, for maintaining faith, look at the surrender and submission and the consequent empowerment that Krishna provided to that person. If there's someone that, in the course of serving in that way, either Maya slammed them, or perhaps their submission slackened, or perhaps they became proud because that little success, and they became the enjoyer of that little success and became proud. You know, we should learn our lesson. Let each one of us not make that same mistake. Let each one of us not become proud. or slacken in our submission, or become, you know, a enjoyer of a little success, a little, you know, doing something right and then become the enjoyer of that, doing something right for a change. Stay always very humble. And that's my answer to this faith issue. If one who does so is protected. So be one of the ones that's protected, rather than one who becomes a little proud. And stay protected by staying in close association of those who are humble and those who can guide you properly. If you start becoming a little proud, they can bang in the head and say, you know, Prabhu, humble up a little bit here. This isn't good. And then we say thank you instead of saying, why'd you hit me in the head? I was enjoying. When there are loving relationships amongst the devotees, then that kind of communication can take place. But when we're holding ourselves aloof or apart from loving relationships, anything could happen at any time, and when that's the case, generally it does. Something will happen. But that person who has, go back to the starting point, that person who has done some wonderful service, that shouldn't be dismissed or minimized. It's glorious. It's that soul's eternal advantage. To their eternal credit. A little variety in these questions. How to approach an increase in chanting? Short answer is a step at a time, incrementally. Make increases in your chanting a little at a time and maintain it over a period of time. And after you've maintained for a period of time, then another little increase over a period of time. That's a general rule. Sometimes devotees make these big quantum increases in chanting, and sometimes it stays. And it's nice when it stays, and it's not nice when it doesn't stay. So, as a rule of thumb, make efforts to increase chanting in a in incremental steps. And another response to this is, if you want to increase your chanting, then increase the feeling behind your chanting, and your chanting will increase. In other words, you don't go for an increase in chanting with feeling, and when you're chanting with feeling, you will want to increase. But you go for an increase of chanting, and you'll be wondering, you know, some days I'm feeling like chanting, and some days I'm not. But I made this increase, now what do I do? Okay, here's another very different question. How should we approach leaving a loved place because of a material situation? Example, leaving Chicago's great community for some other place where it is not as conducive to devotional service because of a job situation, etc. How should we approach leaving a loved place because of a material situation? Well, we can think of Srila Prabhupada, and he left a loved place, Vrindavan. He loved Vrindavan. And where he was in Vrindavan, he said, it's the most sacred place in the universe, even though Rupa Goswami says that Radhakund is the most sacred place in the universe. Just outside his window was the place of Rupa Goswami, his bhajan kutir and samadhi. And the place where all the Goswamis would come on a regular basis and have Krishna Katha, and that's where he was residing, in those two little rooms in Radha Damodar. He had such a wonderful situation. And he left that wonderful situation. He left his home, he left where his heart was, to go to another place. But it was for service. And because of service, there was separation from that loved place. And he returned. And then he left again. Because of service. So when we're in the mood of service, we can carry the feeling of that place with us and execute some service. Be an extension of those loving relationships that you left behind, and expand the network of loving relationships in the next place. As part of your service. And then when you meet those devotees at that other place and you go back for a visit to that loved place, you have them come with you and they go, wow, this is really wonderful. And you're effectively extending the network of loving relationships as a service. In a life of devotion, something that experience tells, I don't know the exact verse, but there's something in the Old Testament of the Bible that speaks something about there's a season for all things. You know, there's a time of life for this and there's a time of life for that. It's just how life is arranged. So there's a time where one may come together, there's a time where one may disperse. And in that dispersing, it's a different feeling, and it's a different maturing of one's Krishna consciousness that's required to go more deeply than in the dependency, or the over-dependency on the circumstance, and cultivate and nurture that essence which one has received and grow it. And then extend it to others. And that same opportunity isn't there, or may not be taken advantage of, when you're in the midst of that former situation. And it's not that Krishna puts us in situations where we're, you know, we can't grow in Krishna consciousness or mature in our spiritual lives. Each circumstance Krishna arranges for us has its opportunity. Wow. When it is so difficult to go back from the material world, I assume that's to the spiritual world, why is it so easy to come into it? Or it was equally difficult? Interesting question. Let's share this. There's been a flurry of discussion. I was thinking of sending it out in our GBC conference, that we have GBC members and GBC deputies, and there's a whole group of people that are part of a conference. So somebody started this topic of the fall of the jiva. And there's a lot of talk on this conference about the fall of the jiva, as this is being asked about. So one of the things that somebody said was, why are we making such a big deal about this issue? Because our acharyas hardly even spoke about it. This is a call I'm expecting from Gopal Bhatta. Yes, it is. Just a sec. Gopal Bhatta, can I ring you back? Yeah, it's probably with caller ID here. I'm in the middle of a class and I'll just ring you back. How much time you have? Break. Oh, good. Call you back. Thanks. Okay. It's an important call. So I left my cell phone on. Bhakti Vaibhav Maharaj. Oh, yeah. Someone was saying, why are we all this big? Because our acharyas never spoke about it. So Bhakti Vaibhav Maharaj, this has been going on for about 2 weeks. He said, very curiously, somebody gave me a book that was a compilation by some professor, blah, 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 some professor, not like, you know, doesn't give his devotee name, just professor something, that had gone through the writings of our acharyas and pulled out very explicit things that they said about the fall of the jiva, you know, from Vaikuntha to this realm. When I have some more time than I've been having lately, I'll put it all together in like a little document and send it out. But very, very explicit. You know, Jiva Goswami, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, not just, you know, verses from the Bhagavatam and purports from Srila Prabhupada, but our acharya speaking explicitly on this topic. Comparing the Jaya and Vijaya fall to other living entities that come and so on and so on. It's like a very involved topic. So living entities falling, it's less than a second. And returning, it's less than a second. Prabhupada says, when we return to the spiritual world, there will be the sense that it was just like a blink of an eye. Inconsequential, fragmental, fraction of a time. Because in fact, it's illusion. How many drops are there? How many drops of water are there in a desert? How much time is there in illusion? So it's illusion. So the difficulty is we're attached to illusion. That's why it's so difficult. We're attached to our, you know, our misery. The sources of misery. Not so much attached to the misery. We're attached to the sources of misery. The source of the misery is ignorance. Does it make sense? Not at all. The whole thing doesn't make sense. And that's the nature of illusion. I was at a home program in Tennessee, and I was told the family that's the host of the program wants to invite a whole bunch of new people. And they're expecting 15 families to come, all new people. I said, how many committed to come? I said, 15. I said, here's the rule. Divide it in half, and that's how many will come. And they'll come when the program is almost over. They said, no, 15 will come. I said, okay, we'll see. Sure enough, nobody was there except the core devotees, and then those that had promised to come. It was a social obligation. Half of them came. So but the host wanted me to speak something very introductory. So there was nobody introductory to speak to except the youth. So I got the youth. The kids came and sat in the front. And it was kids' class. So that I knew that if the kids were learning, when the guests came in, they would tune in. They wouldn't feel like weird because we're learning kids stuff, because it was for the kids. They would feel comfortable. So I posed the following question for the kids to answer. I said, okay, you guys have an exam. They were younger than you guys, much younger. It's same question. Why is it difficult? You know, imagine, let's take spirit soul, Mr. Spirit Soul. And he is going along, you know, trying to find happiness in the material life, the material world. And he tries it in this life, and he tries it in that species, and he tries it over here, and he tries it over there. And after millions of trying that, so many lifetimes, he finally comes to the position and says, phew, it's not working. I think I want to be with Krishna. Yeah, I want to be with Krishna. Let me just, like, trash all this other stuff that's not working, and let me just go to Krishna. Krishna is very kind. Krishna will accept me. He tries to make a U-turn. And it should be easy to make a U-turn, but, you know, it's not easy to make a U-turn. Just turn around and go to Krishna. So why is it difficult? Asked the kids. And they were, you know, kind of nervous at first, and but then started giving answers. And then a very young girl, 4 or 5 years of age, and she has a speech defect. She can't speak so well. But she raised her hand and said, because the soul says yes, but the senses say, I want sense gratification. And then a boy raised his hand and said, then the mind says, I want to be independent. Okay, you got the answer. The soul is saying, I want to go to Krishna. Why is it so difficult? The senses are saying, no, I want sense gratification. And the mind is saying, give up my independence? No way. Forget it. But the soul is saying, no, I want to go to Krishna. And the conditioned tendency is very strong. So once we're on the treadmill of material life, it's very powerful. Maya is very powerful. She's got a hold on us. And she doesn't let go. Unless Krishna orders her to let go. So there's the test of our will, our test of our determination. Therefore, just like this purport of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he's describing that the bhakti process is sufficient to dissolve this gross and subtle body. But because of attachment, it takes some time. And therefore, bhakti has to be practiced steadfastly over a period of time. The purifying potency is there. Looking for the phrase. Here it is. Only by repeated bhakti, gradually, the realization of Paramatma, or Tat, appears. Because of our conditioned tendency. And it's, you know, because conditioned tendency is there, it's not just a matter of snapping your fingers and say, okay, enough of that, I'm moving on to the next thing. Conditioned tendency is very strong. So, what to do? Should I continue a little bit, or should we have kirtan for a while? Or would you like to just ask spontaneous questions? Or what would you all like to do? You hungry? What's the feedback here? Anyone? Yeah.
My favorite is when you're doing answering questions. This is very nice.
This is very nice. Okay. No one else spoke up, so you win. Okay. I'll go until like another 10, 12 minutes and we'll finish up. I understand that my relation with devotees, especially those guiding me, plays a major role in my progress. I want to strengthen my connection with my mentors. Can you elaborate on how to, it's in quotes, how to do this? Well, how to establish a relationship is the question. We have Rupa Goswami's teaching, Dadati Pratigrinati Guyamakyati Pritchati. But and another statement is, very simply put, just open your heart. Well, how do I open my heart? You express without reservation your feelings and your contemplations and what's important to you. You share that with your mentors, with the qualified persons to share that with. That allows not only what the inner contemplations that are going on to be looked at and shared with by others, but it also opens one to receive something that, the kindness, the mercy, and the wisdom, and the experience, and the guidance of mentors. Both. It means developing a genuine loving relationship. A genuine loving relationship isn't merely formal. Like, okay, I've got a mentor, so I'm supposed to report to them. But it's entering into a loving relationship. And if you can even say to that person who is your mentor, I'm really not so good at this. I don't know how to. So that in itself is a opening of the heart. And it says, I feel even uncomfortable saying it because, that's another opening of the heart. Because, I think I've got some pride going on inside here, and it, doesn't look good if I say I don't know how to. And so with that kind of opening of the heart and sharing what's your internal life and your external life, practically speaking, how do you keep yourself and what's going on? Then it's not just you're on your own. You have the resource of another caring person. And that's strengthening. And that strength then helps you conduct your devotional service and helps you take the next step in that relationship also. So it's a little bit like the question of how do I increase chanting? It's, it's one step at a time. Little by little, that relationship can be expanded. And when you feel strength from that relationship expanding and growing, then you can take further steps. In the popular culture, there is a lot of focus on meditation. But not in the ISKCON movement. Is chanting equivalent of meditation? You bet. They didn't say you bet, I said that. the others are a mechanical version as opposed to a natural version. Let's do this. Mother Jasoda is churning butter. And when she's churning butter for Krishna, she's not this like, another duty to do, and so when that's done, I'll take care of the other things, then I'll take care of the other things and take care of the other things. And then her day is filled up with, household chores. She loves Krishna. And because she loves Krishna, whatever she does is for Krishna. And so when she is doing for Krishna, she's singing. And her churning of this is in the Damodar Leela, it's described by her acharyas. Her bangles are like cartels. They're banging into one another. Ching, 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 ching. And the paddle of the butter urn is the mridanga. Boom, 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 ching, ching, ching. So she's just singing songs of Krishna. She doesn't have her songbook. She's just spontaneously speaking and glorifying Krishna's wonderful pastimes, Krishna's beautiful form, his beautiful face, his decorations, his wonderful loving dealings, his transcendental activities. Boom, boom, ching, ching, ching. She says, so we're not on that spontaneous platform, so we have our sadhana. We have our practices to cultivate. And by by practicing in that way, that's a meditation. Meditation upon what? The other practices of meditation, it's not upon what. It's just meditation. Maybe emptying the mind of all thoughts, and so that you can be peaceful. That's one type of meditation. Or meditating. I saw some pictures of Buddhists meditating. They're like around this circle, and it's a big, big mandala with all kinds of details, and they're leaning over, and for hours they're just fixing their mind upon this mandala on the floor. So that they're fixing their mind on something, so the other thoughts are quieted. And that way, something happens. There's some kind of the roar of the disturbance of, material energy subsides, and it becomes a different variety of the material energy. That's a type of meditation. Etc. So our meditation is meditation on sound, on the sound of Krishna's name. And when we're chanting, that's what it should be. Not just, I've got to chant my rounds, because you're supposed to chant japa. That's part of the Hare Krishna thing. But it's absorbing the mind in the sound of Krishna's name. And when we do like that, it's very powerful meditation. It's very powerful even if we don't do that, if we're just chanting mechanically. But if we're absorbing the mind in transcendental sound. At the Champaign-Urbana program, there was a girl that kept bringing this up. I went over on the side, in the front. Dr. Emoto's work with water, and you say things like, I love you, or peace, or thank you, over water, and then you freeze the water, flash freeze it, and then as the crystals are thawing, put it under high powered microscope and see what the crystals look like. And where it's good thoughts and good vibrations, it's like beautiful crystals. And then when there's other sounds, or even just write a piece of paper, you know, I hate you, or you make me sick, or I want to kill you, or something, you know, mean-spirited. Just even writing on a piece of paper, putting it on the bottle, and then freezing it, and the crystals look all muddy and yucky and really awful, distorted, discolored, horrible. So sound vibration is very powerful, and thought with sound vibration is very powerful, and the holy name chanted with feeling is very powerful. It certainly is a meditation. So we don't describe it as the mechanical system of meditation, but it's our principal practice. It's meditation. It's bringing the mind to focus upon Krishna, Manmana, most effectively through sound vibration. And we'll have a little kirtan at the end, so we'll do our little mantra meditation. This one has already asked some questions. Oh, please share realizations from this recent yatra for the benefit of those that could not accompany. I'll share a few. One of them is the holy Dham is very purifying. I don't know if anybody else who took part in the yatra experienced this, but I experienced it again, as I do each time. As the days went by, you know, having taken part in yatras a number of times now, and, you know, being the one that's preparing and presenting a number of times now, it's not that the repetition becomes, you know, hackneyed. Rather, it allowed me for appreciating more deeply the holy Dham. Like, for example, this Govardhan Parikrama. I was far more conscious as we were circumambulating Govardhan. I wasn't just like looking where I was going and, you know, thinking of the next place. I was looking at Govardhan Hill. Just like, you know, if you're circumambulating Tulsi, you're looking at Tulsi. You're circumambulating the deity, you're looking at the deity. I was feeling, wow, this is a huge deity of Krishna. The whole hill is Krishna. You know, for 22 kilometers of Krishna. Now, you know, 10 hours of Krishna. And the dust of Vrindavan. And it was intoxicating. I mean, you know, in a good way. Spiritually intoxicating. Just spiritually uplifting. I felt as the yatra was going on, it was just like being lifted and lifted and lifted. And it wasn't like, you know, and then it's just lifted out of material existence by contact with the holy Dham and the deities and the devotees and the dust of Vrindavan. Two other things were the deities of the Goswamis are so amazing. Besides, they're beautiful. They're so merciful. They're so accessible. We went to Jaipur on the day of the new moon. And wow, there were so many people there. There were a gazillion people. Just, you know, all over the place. All over the place. You know, right in the middle of the day. I don't know if these people go to work or anything. You know, it was like Janmashtami. One of our big temples. Just on a, you know, middle of the day. It was a Monday. And, you know, devotion. Such devotion. The expression of that devotion was very simple. They bought grains, because it's, you know, the harvest season, so they bought grains and gur. And just like we're pouring grains and pouring gur on the altar. Somebody's coming along and sweeping it up, and someone is pouring the grains and gur on the altar. Someone's coming and sweeping it up. You know, they're just making offerings of the bounty of the harvest to Krishna. And thousands and thousands and thousands. And, you know, it was all day long, thousands and thousands and thousands. Such devotion. The whole city of Karoli is just Madan Mohan, conscious. And this was in November. It wasn't like Kartik. It was, you know, off season. It was packed. And then, you know, we went to Jaipur and Mangal Arati for Radha Govinda. We were told that Mangal Arati was at 4:30. First we were told it was at 5 o'clock, then no, it's 4:30. It turned out it was 5:30. So we were there way ahead of everybody chanting japa, and, you know, they just got crowded and crowded and crowded and crowded and crowded. And, you know, if you give a quarter of an inch, you got five people in front of you. So finally someone said, "You're a sannyasi, you can just go sit up right up front." And I said, "Really?" He said, "No, I don't say anything." So I went and sat up front. I didn't get pushed or anything. And at the end, the pujari brought me right up to the front of the altar. It's like so merciful, the deities. So merciful. So approachable. But, you know, hundreds of thousands of people from Mangal Arati. It's 5:30, but still. The city of Jaipur is just, you know, they love Govindaji. It's an amazing city. So the mercy of the deities, the mercy of the Dham, and another, I've already shared it, but another appreciation is what an amazing disciplic succession we have. Our acharyas are like superstars. They're just amazing personalities. And they're accessible too. If we approach in the proper mood, one can receive their mercy. It's a core part of our Gaudiya teaching to pray for the mercy of the previous acharyas. It's in the songs of our acharyas that they pray for the mercy of our previous acharyas. It's our life as Gaudiya Vaishnavas. And they're merciful. They give their mercy. And they're so elevated. I mean, like, out of sight, elevated. But they give their mercy very freely. If one has the proper mood. So those are some primary thoughts. And I very much appreciated having the opportunity to be with Dina Bandhu and Bhakti Chaitanya Swami. Our own current devotees, they're both Western born, but they're Hindi. I mean, Dina Bandhu, I was giving lecture in English, and then we would have translation in Hindi, Telugu, and Tamil. He lectured in Hindi, and we had an English translator for those of us that couldn't speak Hindi, and Tamil and Telugu. And I asked the Hindi-speaking devotees, how was his Hindi? They said, oh, great. But, you know, he's born in, I think, Seattle, Washington. for something like Oregon or something like that. But he's assimilated the life of Vrindavan so much that he's a Brijbasi. So their association was also a very nice experience for me. I was thinking I'm very much looking forward to the youth yatra in Puri. What to speak of the South India yatra. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Prabhupada Swami Ki Jai.